Welcome to The Excellent Fiduciary, a podcast from Roland Criss, where we explore what it takes to meet and exceed the demands of managing a retirement plan in today's complex market. Now, let's begin today's show with an introduction from our Roland Criss host.
I'm Ron Hagen, and we have a great show today. Thank you for joining us. We're going to talk about a topic that is in the news, and in the news all too frequently for retirement plan fiduciaries, especially in the university sector, where excessive fee allegations against retirement plan fiduciaries have brought a number of organizations, major universities, into the courtroom as defendants in cases where participants, the employees, that is, of the universities are alleging that those charged with the oversight of the retirement plans are failing to monitor costs, and as a consequence, the plan participants are not only overpaying for services like investment advice and administration services, but their investment returns are suffering as a consequence of that. We're going to talk about this issue, which we've captioned, How Smart Fiduciaries Prevent Excessive Fee Lawsuits, with Christine Denton today. Christine is an individual who has been very actively involved in this marketplace and this subject matter area for several years. She is Roland Criss's Senior Vice President of the Risk Practice Group. And under her within her purview, Christine is responsible for administering our firm's assessments of fees paid by retirement plans for the kinds of services I've just mentioned. And before we introduce her into our discussion, I just want to pass on a tip for the day for all of those in the audience who are cast in the role of being a fiduciary or an investment committee member of a retirement plan. Here's the tip. The skill sets needed to act in the role of a fiduciary are not all intuitive. They are acquired. And it's very important that skill sets be developed through training. So find a location, find a resource that provides fiduciary training and update your knowledge of the requirements of fiduciaries on a periodic basis. There are a number of different excellent sources for fiduciary training, one of which is, in fact, on our website at rolandcriss.com. And you may find information there about our self-paced online fiduciary training program. And I encourage you to make that a part of your corporate and career business development game plan. Well, with that in hand, Christine, please join us. And we look forward to your comments and your insights about this important area of excessive fees and the impact they're having in driving lawsuits within the retirement plan community. Welcome.
Hi, Ron. Thanks for having me today.
We're going to dive right into this because these cases are revolving around an idea that's called the contract or arrangement statute related to service providers to retirement plans. And that statute is found in ERISA, Section 408B2. It's the so-called fee disclosure rule. We're going to call it the rule just for brevity's sake here during our podcast. And what we'd like to do today with you is to explore the steps needed to ensure that an enterprise's risk management approach insulates it from what I'm going to call a painful ERISA excessive fee scenario. So that's where we're headed, and thank you very much for participating with us and giving us your insights. The fee disclosure rule obviously affects vendors that provide investment and administration services to retirement plans, but it also affects employers in very important ways. So let's start with the vendors. How have they responded in your experience?
Well, vendors have responded largely as they should have. The disclosures have been enhanced that they're providing to plan sponsors and plan participants. So we're getting more information about fees, which is good. It's contributed to much better fee transparency, as well as the timeliness of disclosures to plan sponsors and participants has been adhered to as well. So we are seeing that pretty consistently across the board. The flip side of that is that the rule really didn't introduce a standardized format, so the disclosures can be largely confusing to plan sponsors.
What is the key objective, in your opinion, of these disclosures from a vendor's perspective? What are they trying to accomplish? What do they need to accomplish as far as their statutory requirement is concerned?
I believe the issue of fee transparency is probably the primary objective that we're going for here, that we'd like to see, that it's, you know, a disclosure that presents the fees in a way that is easy to understand and comprehend by someone who is largely uneducated on the issue, be it that a plan sponsor or a plan participant. So I would say that's probably the key objective from, you know, what we're seeing.
Okay. Well, we've talked about the vendors briefly. What about employers? How have they responded to the responsibility they have under this new rule?
Well, honestly, they're having a hard time grasping the meaning of the rule and how to apply it. We're several years down the road here on the issue of fee transparency, and many plan sponsors are still struggling in this area. It requires an entirely new level of diligence and training and accountability that many of them have not yet adopted.
What does the fee disclosure rule actually require employers to do?
Well, plan sponsors, in response to the rule, must assess their fees in the context of what's needed by the plan. And there are three key facets of the rule that help them accomplish that objective. The first thing is to obtain the disclosures from the vendors, and that sounds pretty simple, but it requires action on the part of the plan sponsor to reach out sometimes and request those disclosures from vendors. The second thing they need to do is look at the disclosures, analyze them, and determine if they can understand the disclosure. It kind of gets back to the issue we talked about a minute ago with respect to, you know, ease of understanding and transparency. A plan sponsor must be able to look at those disclosures and understand exactly how they apply to the arrangements that are in place with their particular plan. And then as a result of all that, once those two issues have been taken care of, then a plan sponsor must determine whether or not the vendor's charges are reasonable. And that's a kind of a muddy issue in and of itself.
Well, it seems like this rule is causing retirement plan sponsors to function more like a supply chain manager. Is that a fair way to characterize what's happened with the fee disclosure rule?
Yeah, I would agree with that. The rule outlines a mandate for the selection of providers that are based on the overall value of their services to the plan, and fees are really only one aspect of that. A plan sponsor must be able to look at the services that they have lined up for the plan and determine whether or not, determine the balance there between, you know, what is the quality of the service they're receiving with respect to the fees. Much like, you know, any other service that a corporation would engage, you would want to make sure that you're receiving value for the money that's being paid for that service.
It sounds like from what you've said then that the fee disclosure rule is not that difficult to comprehend in terms of what vendors and retirement plan sponsors are required to do, but maybe the disclosures that are being made are, because of their non-standardized nature, make it a bit challenging to understand where an employer should actually start in complying with the rule. So what would you suggest an employer do to get started in order to ensure that they're in compliance with their side of this rule?
Well, I think the first place to start that is easiest for most people is the issue of benchmarking. The Department of Labor doesn't require benchmarking as the end result of the reasonableness test, but it certainly is a good place to start. It's easily quantifiable. And, you know, the fees in the industry are presented in a way right now that allows them to be compared against each other. One thing I think that is inherent in the problem with benchmarking, though, is the way fees are standardized in the industry at this particular point in time is that we're really looking not so much at the fees that plans are actually paying, but we're looking at the rate, the billing rate, if you will. For example, if you were to hire an attorney to provide services to your corporation, that attorney would quote you a billing rate, and then that billing rate would be applied against the hours actually spent on the project. In the same way with plan services, a plan provider such as a record keeper might quote you a rate that is presented as a percentage, an asset-based charge against the total assets in the plan. That is not the actual fee to the plan. The actual fee to the plan are those dollars that the plan or the participants are actually distributing to that vendor. But right now, that's kind of where we are in the industry with respect to benchmarking, is that the benchmarking is being presented as a comparison of different vendors' billing rates. So it's important for plan sponsors to delve deeper in that benchmarking issue and not just rely on benchmarking as the final means for determining the reasonableness of their plan's fees.
Well, it seems like, if I were to summarize what you've just said, it's important to focus in on dollars, not mm-hmm. billing rates.
Right.
That's right. In a read of a recent lawsuit in preparation for today's podcast, I did notice that there was some discussion in the presentation made by the plaintiff lawyer about the fees being excessive from a dollar perspective. So this is, I understand now better what you're saying, and that makes all the sense in the world in terms of how the courts are looking at the fee issue. Well, plan sponsors are presented with a significant challenge, it sounds like, in sorting through what could be, for many, an unusual kind of a business skill set, and that is understanding retirement plan fees. Is there a place in a plan sponsor's compliance activities for a third party to assist them? That would be a third party that doesn't have a vested interest in the outcome, in evaluating the appropriateness of fees.
Absolutely. I think a lot of times plan sponsors, like I said, they struggle with the issue. They struggle with understanding the issue, how to apply it, what reasonableness even means to them. And having a third party come in that is not connected to the plan, you know, in the way services are provided. Another way to say that is, you know, they're not one of the service providers to the plan whose fees will be benchmarked or assessed through the exercise can be extremely valuable and helpful to a plan sponsor in, you know, understanding how to apply this determination of reasonableness to their own situation.
In the time we have remaining, I wonder if you could give us a feel for what the objectives of an examination of fees should accomplish.
Sure. Yeah, I think there are really five key objectives that we want to look for when we're walking through a fee reasonableness exercise. And I think any plan sponsor can take these objectives as well. But really, we want to get to a point where a common language has been produced through the disclosures that the service providers have given to the plan sponsor. Many times, plan sponsors don't understand the terminology and the fee, you know, the statement of fees and the way, just the way the industry operates. And so it really allows employers to become educated on the issue of fees and allows them to speak the same industry speaks as the providers that they're working with. The next thing it can do is it can really help clarify the vendor servicing boundaries. In many cases, we work with plan sponsors whose service agreements with providers have been tucked away in a file for years, and they've never been looked at. And so they don't really understand what to expect that service provider to do for them. And that's a critical element in determining the reasonableness of your fees, is understanding what the vendor should be doing for you. And so we would hope that this exercise would clarify those servicing boundaries and then also help them understand the fee structure, simplify that so that it's not a mystery, so that, you know, we can unbundle those fee arrangements and help plan sponsors understand exactly what's being paid for what service. It can also establish performance metrics going forward. It's a great way to benchmark your plan. It's a really good way for a plan sponsor to demonstrate diligence and monitoring of the providers of the plan, so that year to year you can look and see how the fees are changing. You can, you know, monitor the successes in the reduction of fees, you know, where that happens. And it also helps you keep tabs on the level of service with respect to your fees, because you don't want to, and this kind of gets into the fifth objective, you don't want to have a reduction of service at the same time as the fees are being compressed. The idea is to maintain the same level of service, but for a more efficient pricing structure. So those are the areas that we always look to fulfill and hope that the rule is fulfilling that for plan sponsors.
Well, thank you for that list of objectives. That's a pretty aggressive undertaking, and it explains the reason that so many plan sponsors find it challenging to actually comply with the fee disclosure rule. Well, your group has conducted literally hundreds of assessments of fee structures under the fee disclosure rule for plan sponsors in every sector, nonprofit, commercial enterprise, and so on. What benefits are you observing that employers are gaining from conducting a retirement plan fee assessment?
The first one that I can see that just jumps out at me is it really clarifies and updates a plan sponsor's arrangements with vendors. Like I said before, a lot of contracts are sitting in files and they're not understood. And so this is a great opportunity for a plan sponsor to look at a vendor's arrangement with them, clarify any gaps in service that might be happening, maybe look at service levels and determine if some of those are even needed anymore. You know, a lot of the things that are built into a plan servicing model at the beginning of a plan, as the plan grows and matures and kind of gains track record, some of those things are not necessarily required anymore. And so it's important for a plan sponsor to be looking at those service arrangements and, you know, modifying them as the needs of the plan and the plan participants change and grow. It also eliminates the fees that are paid and who pays them. I think a lot of confusion lies with a plan sponsor as to who is actually paying some of the fees in the servicing arrangements. Some fees are paid by the adopting employer. So, we generally see record keeping fees, TPA fees, attorney's fees, those types of ministerial fees related to administering a plan are sometimes paid by the employer. And I think a lot of employers might just assume that the plan is paying those and vice versa. A lot of times the plan is picking up those fees and maybe the employer would like to, help the employees out by pulling some of those fees away and paying those out of corporate assets. So it's a good opportunity to look at the fee structures and really have a firm understanding of who is paying what fee. And then it quantifies a vendor's value through that determination of reasonableness. The natural outcome of that is just, a determination of the value of the services that you're receiving. And I think that's really the heart of the DOL's rule is that they want plan sponsors to understand the value of the services that they're receiving. And if there is not value there, then, what changes need to be made to make sure that value is in there. And then lastly, I think it serves as a great tool of demonstrating prudence. It's also a legally defensible tool. It's a great thing for a plan sponsor to have in their governance file to show and demonstrate that they are monitoring their plan sponsor or their service provider arrangements. And it's also evidence that plan sponsor is working toward adherence to a very high fiduciary standard and compliance with ERISA, which is, where a lot of a plan sponsor's risk lies is, in compliance or non-compliance with that set of regulations. So it's a really great tool for a plan sponsor to have to demonstrate their own prudence in administering the plan.
Well, Christine, these are great comments and give terrific insights into what the impact of the fiduciary side of the equation on the fee disclosure rule amounts to and how a retirement plan committee needs to be thinking about its compliance responsibilities under that rule. Well, as we close, there's one final question I know we get asked frequently from chief financial officers and committee chairs of fiduciary committees. What kind of qualifications, in your opinion, should a retirement plan sponsor be looking for when they look to outside help to conduct a retirement plan fee assessment?
Well, I think the first thing you would want to look for is someone who actually specializes in the work. As you can kind of infer from some of the things we've talked about, it can be complex in trying to understand and piece together all the requirements of the rule, even though there are three mandates in the rule that a plan sponsor needs to adhere to. Those can become tricky in, you know, walking through and understanding what those disclosures say, whether or not they're transparent enough or appropriate enough. And someone who does not work in that area day to day might have a difficult time explaining that or, you know, helping a plan sponsor understand that, as well as, you know, they're could potentially be conflicts in those service models as well. If someone who is conducting a fee reasonableness test is also a provider of fees that are being tested in the determination of reasonableness. So you would not want to hire a vendor that is already providing services to your plan that are going to come under that test of reasonableness. You'd want to have someone, obviously, that has solid references, who is actively working in the industry, that, you know, has strong client relationships in that particular field already. And then an important thing in today's age of litigation is making sure that they're part of your due diligence of that provider is that they their work has been tested through litigation, whether it's on the defendant or the plaintiff side. You want to make sure that the work that they've done has been upheld by the courts.
Christine, thank you very much for your contributions to our podcast today. It makes me remember that I should inform our audience that there are tools that your group, the Risk Practice Group of Roland Criss, has developed that can be found on our website at rolandcriss.com that are very useful in helping plan sponsors meet the demands of the fee disclosure environment in which we currently operate. Well, to our audience, we thank you very much for joining us today. And if any of you would like help in making changes to your retirement plan system that ensures that it's complying with state-of-the-art requirements, please visit us at rolandcriss.com online, or you may call us at 1-800-440-3457. I'm Ron Hagen, and I hope you have a terrific day.